Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 7th, 2015, and welcome to episode 102 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and also ant invasions. My name is Jack Nutting. I'm your host for today. With me, we have our round table consists of four people, so it's a square table today. We have Paul Hagstrom. Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. Not much going on. Summer's here.
Good. Summer's not quite in Sweden yet. I don't think it ever is. I'm not going to give it that, though. We also have Farther West, Earl Evans. How are you today, sir?
Feeling very square. Thank you.
Nice. And in the great northern hinterland, which is, you're probably not as far north as I am, but seriously, you're north of most people anyway. Carrington Vanston, how are you doing today?
I am great. I am personally north of most people. how I choose to view myself. And also, I'd like to... Point of order here. I believe that four people can sit around many shapes, not just squares.
That's true.
We could sit around a crescent. We could sit around a circle.
Yes, but this is the hippest shape.
I don't know. Trapezoids are nice, too.
Just poorly made tables.
you could think of it as a 3D-looking square. It's tilted into a third dimension you can't see. All right, anyway.
You can see into a third dimension. It's like one of my many powers.
It's so great to have you back.
And I'm only here for the first half of the show. So, listeners, you've only got like 45 minutes to get through, and then you can turn off.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that everyone is doing well and in good moods today. My mood today has been a little bit skewed by the fact that I left the house for several hours, came back to find that my kitchen was being invaded by ants. And we'd had a problem with some ants in the kitchen before. We found, okay, well, they came from this outside, from this outer wall, and there was a slight hole down the molding, so we put some ant poison there, and that stopped. We still saw a trickle, like now and then we would see one or two in the morning, and today, we got home and there's a whole bunch of them up on the counter and stuff. And we figured out they're actually coming now through our old dead dishwasher. They're somehow sneaking in through the dishwasher, climbing out of it, getting past the rubber seal, and walking around the room, which is terrible. So we had to spread out more ant poison and all this stuff. But this led me to today's host topic, which is about bugs. So you've seen them, you complained about them. Maybe, if you're like me, you've created some yourself. The bugs we encounter on our retro systems can seem like a different beast than the ones we have on our modern computers. On the one hand, we have no manufacturer offering support for the buggy old software and hardware, so we can't really complain and expect to get anything done about it. But on the other hand, the simpler design that is inherent to our older systems means that we have some chance of being able to actually track down and fix bugs ourselves, in hardware to some extent, and even more so in software. So I'm just wondering what if you guys have any interesting stories about old bugs that have bit you in recent times. I'm thinking, it's one thing to have had something. Everyone hits bugs now and then. But at some point in your dealings with retro systems, if you have interesting stories about a time where suddenly a bug that escaped somebody 30 years ago came around to bite you today. Let's go around in the same order. Paul, do you have any interesting stories come to mind?
Well, I have definitely run across things like this. I don't think I've fixed any myself, but it does bring to mind a discussion that I'm not going to be able to completely bring back into my memory. But fairly recently on the CompSys Apple II news group, there was some discussion of taking the Wizardry game and sort of decompiling it, and in the process fixing a couple of bugs that were left in it. So that seems like a sort of interesting exercise, and well beyond, I think, my capability dealing with this was Pascal, so it was coming, it was backing it out from P code into something readable. And but it was sort of an interesting story, and so you can probably search for Wizardry CompSys Apple II in like the past 6 months or something, and you'd probably find that story. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, I guess I don't have any specific stories.
Okay, well, that's interesting. There's actually been a fair amount of discussion now and then in the Atari IPA community about the Star Raiders game. How this reminds me. There's kind of, it's not exactly a bug, but a weak feature where when enemy ships explode, they kind of slow down the whole display, which otherwise is very nice and fluid. And there are definitely people who are proposing different strategies for trying to re-implement this in a better way by also disassembling this, producing the 6502 assembly, and finding a better way to do some sort of floating point division algorithm that would make it not slow down and get so laggy. It's interesting that this year, I haven't heard this about the Ultima side of things. Earl, how about you? What comes to mind for you?
I haven't encountered a bug that was old actually for quite a long time. What I encountered most recently was a bug in an emulator trying to emulate a system that was old. I was playing with Vice, the Commodore emulator. It's a multi-system emulator. It does the VIC-20 and the 64 and the 128 and the plus 4 and the 16 and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, this was kind of a weird case. I was emulating NTSC-based Commodore 128, and it's 40 column mode. And I switched to a split screen mode that it has, where it does part of the screen is graphics and part of the screen is text. The Apple II has a real similar mode, where I think it's your bottom four lines of screen are text, and then everything above it is graphics. And when I did this, the screen started to flicker really badly. So I thought, I wonder if this is an actual bug on the machine. So I went to my real 128 and did the same thing, and it worked without a problem. So I guess this is one I'm going to have to submit.
Yep, there you go. Maybe one you can help fix.
Yeah, maybe.
And actually even just narrowing it down to, provide the minimum use case that actually triggers the bug can be helpful to fixing it, even if you don't write the code yourself.
And a lot of the activity that goes on in the Commodore world is across the pond there in Europe.
Sure.
So I think in a lot of cases they're using the PAL version of the emulation. This might just have been one of those edge cases. It's like, on a full moon, like on the second Tuesday, if you do this particular thing, then you hit the bug. So, just finding it actually is helpful.
Yep. Oh, definitely. Carrington, how about you? You got
unlike you guys, I've encountered like a billion bugs, so maybe I'm unlucky or something like that. So primarily, though, where I've encountered them back in the day and more recently is in playing games. Early games would not always have the best testing periods, best quality assurance, and so frequently they would have either bugs in them or things Sony hadn't thought of that would render a game unplayable. Happened a lot in text adventures and that sort of thing. Big one I remember is when I finally got around to playing the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, Infocom version, and you have to collect all these tools, and there's this part later in the game where you have to use a tool, and I think there's like 10 tools that you can collect, and if you don't collect them all, no big deal, you're just going for points, but the game is specifically programmed to always ask you for a tool you don't have, so the only way to finish is to get every tool. If you get 9 of the 10 and you don't know there's a 10th one, it'll always ask you for the 10. It's not random, it's programmed to be mean. I'm like, come on, not technically a bug, but given that there was like no explanation of that, it drove me crazy. But frequently in other adventure games, things like Dondra and stuff, there could be what I would consider a bug. Like if you go into the rooms in the wrong order, or you pick up an item and you drop it in a certain room, it'll simply vanish, and that'll be an item that you need later on. So in adventure games, it would frequently be bugs that would vex me, and just because you would do something that the author hadn't thought of, or the guess the verb game, that sort of thing. The one bug that I think really stands out hardware-wise for me is like a retro computing bug, but did bite me back in the day. But I think of it as my first really vexing hardware bug on the Apple II. I had two disc twos at the time, and one of them had like a belt problem. So it could create discs, it could read its own discs, but other drives would just say, no, this is not a disc. And so it was a drive, I had one drive that could really only create and read its own discs. I was younger at the time, and I divided the world into, you know, analog and digital. And so this was a computer, it was a digital thing. It was better because it wasn't that flaky analog and all that. And so it drove me crazy trying to figure out what the problem with these drives were. Finally, somebody suggested it might be like a belt thing. I scoffed at that because, come on, no, it's you don't understand. It's digital. Digital to young Carrington means it just is, you know, digital. And so I opened up the drive and inside looked to my little eyes like a little record player. Like there's this thing with a little belt. And I was like, well, that's crap. What is this nonsense? I remember it was like a eureka moment, but it was also remarkably offensive to me that this thing that I thought was the future that was all digital. Because I'd opened up the Apple II itself quite a bit. You'd look inside and look at all this solid state wonder. All it is ICs and the future goodness. But secretly, inside the hard drive, were just gears and belts and old-fashioned nonsense, and I found it very offensive. But then I learned that day that, you know, sometimes you just got to think outside the little box. So that's, I think, the earliest hardware bug I can remember. And the memory of it and being so offended by the existence of that belt has stayed with me to this day.
Nice. It is pretty fantastic, the realization that a disk drive is inherently, it's like no better than a cassette recorder. It's just like, you know, it's still got the same problem of like belts and gears and spinny things and just like...
And magnetic read heads and all that. And it made me very dubious about floppy drives, about hard drives, until like, you know, relatively modern things, and when we finally went solid state for storage. But for the longest time, I was much more skeptical, even cynical, about hard drives than most other people, because I was always so aware of that rapid spinning disk and the little magnetic read head and the nonsense of a design that is, and the idea that, like, let's just make it faster. Let's just make the bits smaller. It's like, no, this is just going to explode. So I've always been very dubious about hard drives because of it. So I guess it was a bug. It was also a lesson well learned.
Cool. All right. Very good. Thanks, guys, for your input on bugs, old and new. It's time to move on to some listener feedback. First of all, I want to mention that we got several people mentioning an item that I'm just going to mention briefly. There was a story about a woman who dumped some junk from her garage off to recycle, and it turned out that in the junk was an Apple I. So, note to all listeners, be careful so you don't throw away your Apple I in the garbage. And we heard about that from several listeners, and I think each of us probably saw that multiple times everywhere. That story was kind of all over the place. So much so that I think we don't even talk about it more, because probably everyone's heard this. But there are other interesting things. Richard sent us a story about the Model 100 Roomba, which is the classic Roomba cleaning robot with a TRS-80 Model 100 portable computer attached to it through the serial port, so that you can actually do some programming on the Model 100 straight to the Roomba, and with the keyboard the computer actually mounted on top of the Roomba itself, full size keyboard and all. Very cool thing.
It looks very funny. I mean, yeah, this little, you know, Model 100 riding the Roomba around.
To me, it screams logo.
Yeah, you want to cover the floor of a room with dust, colored dust, and then...
Dirt up, dirt
use
down.
Logo to program the Roomba turtle graphic style to move around the room and draw patterns in the dust.
Vacuum down, move forward, rotate, vacuum up.
Yep. What else? Tony sent us a link to Amiga, a visual compendium. Anybody look at this? It's an interesting looking project just to put in sort of book form a lot of the visuals from Commodore Amiga games and whatnot. I just kind of quickly scrolled through this thing. I'm not really sure what the deal is on when this is coming out. There was a Kickstarter campaign, and it looks like they reached their goals. I don't know if this is shipping yet or what. It looks like they have pictures of the actual book being opened and flipped through. So printing is certainly underway. I don't know if it's shipping yet or not, but it looks very cool. I had an Amiga back in the day, and I remember playing a lot of these games and seeing a lot of these graphics, and it's like a pretty neat thing.
I think it's a follow-on to a Commodore 64 version, isn't it?
That could be, yeah, because there was one of those as well. So this, yeah. I don't know what the relation is, if it's the same people behind this or not, but I would say it definitely kind of belongs with the others in some sense. There's also a C64, a visual compendium. There's a review of that as well on the same site. And I saw it just from a few months ago. So
they did not ask me to contribute. I would have given interesting pictures.
Yeah. People don't ask us to contribute enough of anything, do they? We're the experts on this.
Yeah, totally.
Anyone who doesn't know what they're talking about will certainly believe that we are experts.
We can pass for experts in many contexts.
Right.
You know, I recently completed a game on Facebook in which you had to correctly identify the names of 1980s video games based on their screenshots, and I got them all right. Therefore, I am an expert. So.
Wow. You should put that on your resume.
It's a good idea. I'll put that on LinkedIn. All right. Anyway, our next item. This is a pretty cool one. Mark submitted a link to someone who has ported the old Dragon's Lair video disc arcade game to the Sinclair ZX81. And this is pretty cool. They've taken the original video off the video disc, or laser disc rather, and converted it into a format, a very like low res, low color format, that is just compact enough to be kind of streamed off of RAM, some sort of RAM expansion on the ZX81, and you can play the game. And so you can actually buy from them a 4 GB SD card with a printed Dragon's Lair label on the tiny SD card. And assuming you have the right expansion thing for your ZX81, it's called the ZX Expand 2. You need to have that thing. And then you plug in the card, and away you go. Play Dragon's Lair on your ZX81.
Yeah, that's insane.
It is pretty insane.
I mean,
one
I guess
of the nice things about it. Oh, sorry, I was just going to say that it's being sold on the sellmyretro.com site, which has a lot of auctions and things for sale. And I'd never heard of the site before, so it also introduced me to a new site to buy things.
Cool. I guess Dragon's Lair is probably not. I mean, you know, the video is the hard part. The actual game control is nothing. So
right,
because the game is awful.
Yeah, I have to say, I agree.
No agency. It's nonsense. It's not even. It's not a game. It's a video with occasional button presses.
Yep. Agreed. So it was an extremely frustrating game to play because it looked so fun. It looked so amazing, and then it's like once you play, it's like, oh wait. I have to wait until the exact right moment and press the exact right direction. Like, and it's just, you either do exactly the right thing or you instantly die.
It's a really pretty version of the game Simon.
Yeah.
It should have been just Don Bluth presents Pretty Simon.
Moving on, we have some other items of interest that we have chosen ourselves, carefully curated from the world of internet news items. Carrington, you're up first with something interesting.
American genius is not an oxymoron. It is instead the title of a series of, I guess it's going to be a mini series, so it's a series of episodes, but also a website. I don't know. First one in this series is what caught my eye. It is Steve Jobs versus Bill Gates in a grudge match. I have not seen the actual episode that has now aired and come and gone. So I don't know if that was any good, but I can say that the website design, which I think is a National Geographic thing, is really well done. It's essentially a somewhat interactive, mostly just slidey aroundy big infographic. You scroll down and it's very pretty. So if you want a quick overview that's relatively unbiased and seems relatively accurate-ish of sort of the track that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and their relative tech companies took during the vintage period, it's a really neat looking overview. Just sort of visually pleasant. It's a very pretty presentation. So we will have a link in the show notes. Did any of you guys actually get to see the show?
Nope. I saw some comments about it, but I've not seen it.
Yeah. I watched the trailer, I think like the day before it aired, and then haven't actually watched the thing, but it was really, really dramatic. I mean, like,
oh goodness.
So I don't have a lot of hope for it, although, I mean, you know, whatever. It's kind of neat to get this stuff into a little bit wider circulation so people know what it is that we, you know, are, why we are interested in these things. But yeah, no, I expect that it is not going to be even all that fun to watch. Watching the trailer is worth it because it's, you know, it's a nice contained amount of stuff to watch, and you can sort of get a flavor for just, you know, how ridiculous it is.
is it like a docudrama of sorts with actors acting out the parts, or is it just, yeah, or is that the idea?
Yeah. And I mean, they do have some, you know, sort of real hardware around, and stuff, but it's, you know, there's lots of sort of dramatic shots and, you know, narration over the action and stuff, but it is reenacted. Okay. And, actually, it's reenacted, and they do have some interviews with people. So Steve Wozniak is in there, and apparently Mitt Romney is in there for some reason as well, talking about old tech.
That's interesting. Well, maybe in his days of being some sort of financial shark, taking over companies and, you know, buying things up and tearing them apart and selling them off for smaller pieces. Maybe he was involved in the tech world in some sense. I'm sure he's involved in tech companies.
You can find out in the upcoming book, A Shark Named Mitt.
Maybe he just played a lot of the you know, Microsoft Olympic decathlon in preparation.
That's probably it. All right. Earl, what do you have to tell us about the Amiga?
Well, what do I have to tell you about the Amiga? Many things. It's a wonderful computer, and there's actually going to be a book now, and it was thought for a while that there wouldn't be this book. You guys are familiar with Brian Bagnell? Wrote Commodore Company on the Edge. Has anyone read that book?
I have not, actually.
I own it, but I have yet to read it.
Ah, it's actually a really good work. And a lot of the story of Commodore in the early to mid years is told through the voices of the people who work there. Very similar to the way you might see Jason Scott do a documentary. You know what I mean? There's a lot of quotes, kind of carries you through the story through quotations of the people who were there on the ground doing it. There was supposed to be a sequel, The Amiga Years, by the same author. It was on Amazon for a while, available for pre-order, and then it went away. And the word was that the project had been canceled, and there was much weeping and gnashing of teeth. And it appears now that it's uncanceled, and it's back up on Amazon with a projected ship date of November 2015. So I just wanted to let people know I'm really hoping for this, because it would be good to get, as they say, the rest of the story.
Neat.
Yep. Cool.
And I really enjoyed the first book, by the way. About the only thing that rubbed me the wrong way about the first book was there was maybe a little bit too much rah-rah, Commodore is great. You know, I think the author, Brian Bagnell, was sensitive to the fact that Commodore's kind of been consigned to the dustbin of history when, in fact, they were actually very influential in the 80s microcomputer scene. So that comes through just maybe a little bit too strongly in some areas. But aside from that, it's a good factual read about things that went on at Commodore. If people aren't tuned in to all of the company hysterics that went on in those days that could be very illuminating. And that's all I got to say about that.
Cool. I would say probably that combined with The Future Was Here by Jimmy Marr, a pair of great things to read for anyone who wants to get deep into the Commodore Amiga story.
Yes. And combined with, I'm hoping, in the other camp, Business's War,
yes.
when that book comes out for the Atari world.
Yep, that should be a good one as well. I've read the previous book, Business is Fun. I've read part of it, and it's a lot of interesting stuff there. They had a lot of editing problems, which they're aware of, which led to gives a kind of an amateurish impression overall in some ways, even though the information is fantastic and they've done a huge amount of research. So, looking forward to seeing what they do with the next book there in that series. Okay, moving along. I have the next item. It's something that I just came across, which looks pretty cool. It's a thing called the Arduboy. This is a credit card-sized gaming machine based on Arduino, of course, hence the name. It's on Kickstarter, still available for backers to charge $39 or more. You'll get one of these when they are first done. They're working on manufacturing this in China, and it looks pretty slick. It's again credit card size, obviously thicker than a credit card, but in terms of its other dimensions, about like a credit card. 6 buttons, so there's like a D-pad and 2 buttons. Tiny black and white OLED screen, and it seems to literally be black and white. Like each pixel is either on or off. There's no sort of shades of gray involved here at all. It's supposed to have a number of games right off the bat, and of course, this being an Arduino thing, you can make your own games for it. Looks very cool. It even had some weird things like it does have a USB port on the bottom, which is used for charging and I guess for transferring data over. And this thing can actually, in some way, act as a keyboard. Like the key presses on this can trigger keyboard events on a computer, that sort of thing. So you can actually use that Ooh. Tiny little buttons as a controller of sorts for things.
Neat.
So it looks like a very cool of a gaming device for $40. And the fact that, you know, the games, at least what's made there available from the beginning, they had this Arduboy arcade. So all the games on there are going to be free and open source, and they want people to be able to sort of hack around with these things and make their own games and do whatever they want with them. Looks like a very cool thing. Tiny little 8-bit handheld game platform. Worth looking into, I think. And this project is, see, the Kickstarter is done in, as I speak these words, 66 hours. So a few days left to get all on board for the first round of machines from this.
And it's been remarkably funded.
Yeah, way, way overfunded. Oh my God, overfunded. This thing, their goal was $25,000, and at this point they're up over $400,000. So there seems to be a market for their device. I think they're going to make it. Next up, Paul, you just want to tell us about Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah, right. Yes. No. This is a relatively short note. But one of the other podcasts out there, Open Apple, they posted sort of like a interview episode, sort of between regular episodes. This is an interview with John Brooks that Matt Ownby made. And so John Brooks wrote the game Rastan on the Apple IIgs. And so what I really liked about I was just very impressed by this interview because it's super technical. So it's really kind of neat to hear somebody talking about all the stuff that, you know, I've been thinking about. And this is somebody who was doing it back in the day and still remembers it all, was talking about how the copy protection was put in on, you know, various types of software and sort of details with how to do graphics on the Apple IIgs and so forth. It's a really, really quite interesting interview. I think it's moderately accessible, but it's very dense and it's super interesting if you're sort of into this stuff at all. So I recommend episode 47.5 as well as the rest of the podcast. Somehow when I heard it, I was just kind of blown away more than usual. So
I completely agree. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. The amount of detail was amazing. I ate it up. I thought it was one of the best interviews, like retro interviews, I've heard in a while.
Cool. That's good. I think there are many podcasts where people tend to sort of shy away from getting in too deep on how the actual programming is done and how, you know, the details of of various tricks to make things happen. I think it's good to talk about these things. We don't need to be ashamed of our tech details. Let it all hang out. That's what I say.
This is a safe space.
Cool. I will have to give that a listen. I'm ashamed to say I don't have Open Apple subscribed in my podcast catcher yet, but I should. Maybe I'll start with this one. Sounds like a good place to start.
Considering it's completely different than all the regular Open Apple episodes.
So will I be let down by the others if I listen to this one first? Is that what you're saying?
No, okay. It's all great, but it is a very different format than the typical shows.
All right. Fair enough. Earl, let's jump back to you. You have an interesting documentary to talk about.
Okay. I actually owe this one to Michael, who wasn't able to be on the show today. He's got an amazingly sore throat. Mm. So shout out to you, Michael. Thanks for this news story. I watched this YouTube short documentary. I think it wound up being about 10 minutes, about the first two computers in the Netherlands. You know, it's interesting. We've talked before. It's a little easy living in America to be kind of Americanocentric when it comes to computing history. So it was really entertaining to watch this video about these two ginormous computers, the ARRA and the ARRA2, that were constructed in the Netherlands. I won't spoil for potential viewers all of the intrigue of this, but I'll talk about a couple of things that interested me. One was the persistence of the visionary behind the project for these two computers. The first one actually didn't work. So there was a lot of gumption necessary to push this project through and actually make something functional, doing something for the first time and wanting it to work. And that we see that as a common thread through some of the first computers that were built. There was a transition of computing from human labor to electronic, meaning that there were these people there that were called computers, just like in England, just like here in the States. And when the computer was actually functional and working, a lot of these folks moved from just doing the data entry and computation to actual programmers. And I thought that was really cool. You know, that's the kind of thing that you like to see, is that when technology comes around, it doesn't just merely displace people, but it enables people to step up to a higher order what they're doing, a more creative pursuit, and let the computer handle the crunching that it's good at. And the other thing that I thought was interesting was the cooperation and the sharing of knowledge and technology with Harvard University, where some of the first computers were built over here. It is in Dutch, and it's subtitled in English. Hopefully that won't throw you off. It didn't throw me off in the slightest. I still enjoyed it very much, so I'd recommend it to people to give a watch. And like I say, it'll only take 10 minutes of your life, and you'll learn something.
Cool. That's really interesting. I think, like you said, there is sort of a focus on the American innovations and the English innovations in this area to the exclusion of almost everything else. So it's interesting to hear about other countries where this kind of research is being done. What was the, roughly was the time period this was happening?
50s. 1950s.
Yeah. Cool. It's definitely one to watch here. Carrington.
Hello.
You're next up.
Hello.
We've got some confessions.
I must confess. Yes. Well, I don't confess. It's a fellow named... Oh, there you go. Christopher. Hey, Chris. Christopher Finn writes, "Confessions of a Tech Nerd, Why I Buy Vintage." I like this article. It's short. It's super fluffy. Comes to a fairly obvious conclusion. But what I liked about it was kind of like a host topic for an RCR. In fact, I'm pretty sure this has in the past been a host topic for an episode of RCR. So it was kind of neat to see somebody else chime in. And I'm always interested when this sort of topic gets out into the media and not on a site that is about retro tech per se. This is a site about tech and business and stuff in general. And just this one guy writing to say, why is it that he owns 14 laptops and 7 desktop computers, but they were all made, decades ago, and why would one want to buy these things? So we all have our own reasons. Many of them are basically the same as this fellow's reason, but I liked it. It's got some pretty pictures of some vintage Apple laptops So it's neat to look at, and I like the topic. So we will have a list in the show notes, or a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I like these pictures of the tower of laptops. It's all stacked up upon one upon the other.
I'd also like to say that Canadians have invented things too, you know. Just saying. Based on that last topic. Yeah. It's not just all Americans. We invented many.
There was maple syrup, right?
We didn't invent maple syrup. We're just fans of it.
We discovered it.
Right. We may have invented poutine, probably, but I don't think we invented maple syrup.
Yeah, this article looks interesting. I have not yet read it. One disappointing fact that I want to say is he keeps talking about the joy and reasons for buying the 21-inch Apple Studio display, big, huge CRT display. But there's no photo of it. He keeps talking about it. Show us the display. Well,
I think they look like the old iMacs.
Yeah, they look like a giant iMac. I've seen this many times. People say, "Wow, what is that big iMac?" I don't know. It's just a screen. It's not actually an iMac. So anyway, cool. Yeah, it's good. Again, we need to get these things out in the open. We need to talk about why we do these things. It's important for us to move on or to just continue. Anyway, continuing along here, Paul, you've got a nice bit of Unix history info.
Yeah, so I thought this was interesting, and I don't feel actually all that qualified to report on it, but I can tell you it's here, and you can do research with everyone else. But so recently posted, there's a Git repository with 44 years of Unix evolution. So it's basically a repository with, you know, lots of historical revisions all the way back to, I think, 1972. Of Unix, sort of organized into commits and releases and so forth, so that you can get a kind of like a snapshot of what it was like at a particular time, what the branching was like. They've done some kind of statistics on it, so you can see, you know, how over time the mean file name length has changed and the percentage of go-to statements has changed and so forth. But it does look like it's something that could allow for serious research, or, you know, also things like being able to pinpoint a single person's contribution, that kind of thing. So it's quite interesting. I suspect I'm not personally going to be digging around in it, but it's cool that it's there. And if I could ever think of something that I wanted to know, so anyway, check it out. There's a page that has kind of like an explanation of what it is and has those graphs I was talking about. And then there's the actual GitHub repository, which, given the way GitHub works, I guess if you clone it, you will have all of the Unixes.
Must have all Unixes.
Yes, they're like Pokemon.
Gotta catch them all. Yeah, this is a very cool thing. And it's the kind of thing that once you see it, it seems so obvious. Like, of course, that's what you want, right? Of course you want to be able to, if you are a Unix geek, you want to be able to like dig into the full details of where it all comes from. Because it's one thing to sort of read about, say, well, yeah, you know, BSD was a branch off of this, you know, V6 version of the AT&Ts. But it's another thing to actually be able to sort of say, okay, wow, there's, you know, the version change from that to that. And it's nice that in the modern era, we can actually sort of roll that up into a single place that everyone can just sort of go and browse with their modern tools and check it all out.
I bet this was a lot of work to compile.
Oh, I'm sure. I don't want to think about it. Huge amount of work. But another nice thing of the open source community is that we can just sort of, we can all benefit from the work of some hardworking maniacs. I think that is the open source slogan. Everybody benefits from hardworking maniacs. That's probably an acronym too or something. All right. Moving along to the next thing. Earl, you've got more about the Amiga. It's good Amiga week here.
I do, actually. And it is a good Amiga week. And also, I will point out that next month, the 30th anniversary is coming up for the Amiga. So there's lots going on at this point. This is a new blog that started up called Amiga Meditations. And in this posting, the blogger talks about how he started out with other computing equipment, didn't think that he could afford an Amiga, but perchance in a rainstorm, he had to take shelter in a computer store of all things, and they had an Amiga there that they'd been trying to sell and couldn't sell it, trying to sell it as a business machine, and nobody was biting, so they'd marked it way down. And they expected to get a cold reception from him. They walked up and started talking to him, and he took out his checkbook, and the rest was history. So I think it's a fun blog, and it was on our spare news section for today, so go check it out.
Yep. I really
enjoyed the writing style, by the way. It was, kind of, what would I say, almost poetic.
Yep, I agree. I read this also a few days ago when it came out, and I saw this posted somewhere. And it's a very nice sort of personal story about how this guy had been wanting to have an Amiga for a while and just could not afford it and couldn't work it out. And then suddenly, just by happenstance, stumbles into somebody who wants to get rid of one. There you go. So this blog only has one entry so far. Is that correct?
That's what I saw. Okay.
So we'll have to wait and see what else we get out of this.
Hover is telling me that AmigaMedications.com is still available should you wish to go a different way.
And if there is never another post, maybe AmigaMeditation.com might also be available.
Just one single meditation.
Though in all seriousness, I also like this style of reflecting on retro computers. I mean, I always enjoy the general history stuff and talking about the chipsets and the software and what sold and what didn't and what have you. But the things that I always find the most interesting are the more personal takes. Like somebody who says, I wanted a particular retro computer to do a particular thing or play a particular game, or I always wanted a certain peripheral and I finally got it and I did this, or I got it and I was unhappy or whatever. Those are always, I think, the most enjoyable takes on this. So I think it's great. I'm not really an Amiga guy, but I also read it and thought it was really enjoyable.
Very good. I think at this point we can move along, and let's move along to this commercial break from our sponsor. In a world of fun and fantasy, an ever-changing guild, and computer terminology, Commodore Guild. Are you keeping up with the Commodore? Because the Commodore is keeping up with you. And we're back. Next up, we come to the retro computing gift idea section. And here's something very cool. From iRobot, the company that makes the Roomba, they have the Create 2 Programmable Robot. This is a robot, a small round thing shaped like a Roomba, that you can interface with and do your own programming of. So again, along the lines of the TRS-80 Model 100 hacked room that we talked about earlier, but this is actually a robot that is designed to be attached to and driven about with your own code. It costs a mere $200. And for 1 week only, there's a free accessory kit with the Lude 330 purchase, whatever that means, and free shipping all robot orders. So this looks like a cool thing that I will not buy for myself, because it's $200. But somebody will surely want to buy this for somebody. What do you think, guys?
I think that with the cost of robotic stuff these days, that's not actually a terrible price for something like this.
Yeah, I mean, compared to like the Lego, what's that robotic stuff called?
The Mindstorms.
The Mindstorms. I mean, that can run a lot more expensive than this thing is. There might be more stuff there too, but.
Well, and there, believe it or not, are even more expensive robotics things that you can get into. But,
oh, I'm sure.
So, yeah, I'd need to read a little bit more about this, how you program it and what the brains are and what sort of sensors, if any, you could attach to it to understand how great a deal it was, but I mean, $200 wouldn't scare me off at face value.
No. Yeah, but if you want to mess around with robotics, this is definitely that's not gonna scare off a lot of people actually.
I've definitely, you know, I have looked at these. I have one of these sort of early Roombas, you know, it just, I don't know, I got in on it early. And actually have barely used it at all because there's too much junk all over my apartment, so it can't actually do its job. But it is actually kind of cute when you set it to go and it just like earnestly bumps up against everything. But I've definitely been kind of looking at this programmable Roomba model for years. You know, I think they've had versions of this for schools for a while. It looks like this one, I think it basically just takes commands. You know, so they're suggesting you hook up a Arduino or a Raspberry Pi or something to send it, you know, the go forward, turn right, you know, react to bumping, that sort of thing. So
yeah, could be a cool thing for the right person who wants to do some of that stuff.
I don't think it does vacuum though. So
no, seems like it does not have that. But they talk about you can attach other things to it. You can do some other things. What that may be, I do not know.
I could get several of them and choreograph them in some sort of Roomba ballet.
That is a great idea. I want to see that on YouTube next week.
Okay, see if I can find $800.
Cool. Well, that's that. Let's move along to our eBay auctions. And I'm going to start off with Earl. What have you got for us today?
Well, actually, today I decided to have a couple of things in the eBay auctions. I'm channeling my inner Paul. The first one is a Hewlett-Packard HP 85 computer. The look of these things has always fascinated me. In my first computer sales job, we actually had these, and I thought they were great looking. I wasn't too wild about the dialected BASIC that they used, but aside from that, I just like the look of the computer. And this particular eBay auction, this specimen of the 85 looks very nice. I've seen some of them that are kind of beaten up. I think maybe because it had the IEEE interface and interface to test equipment, or I'm not sure why a lot of the 85s that you see have seen better days. The other thing is, this seems to work. It turns on, you can type things on it, and you guys know I like it when the eBay sellers test the things that they're selling so that you know it. I mean, at least the thing powers up. I don't know that they show it running a BASIC program, but that's encouraging. So that's my one auction, and the price didn't seem too terribly unreasonable either. So,
yeah, that does look fairly in line with what I would expect. I mean, these are the sorts of things that you always kind of hope you'll catch somebody, you know, trying to just unload junk for $20 or something. But this seems about like the right range.
Yeah, $150 for this in the condition that it looks like it's in just didn't seem out of line. Now, the reason that I have two items today is the second item I thought was very reasonable, but a bit of a risk. So this is a Franklin Ace 1000. A little bit of history with this machine. The last computer store that I worked at, we were not an Apple dealer. And very often, people would walk in and they're in the market for a home computer, and the first thing they're looking for is an Apple II because it's got the most buzz and it's also got the most software by, you know, a pretty good margin. And their kids use Apple at school or whatever, so do you have an Apple II? And when you'd say, no, we don't have the Apple II, we do have the Atari 800, which is a very capable... Hey, come back here! And we'd be running out the door. So... we finally tried to solve that problem by getting the Franklin Ace. And you guys know they had legal trouble with Apple. The Ace 1000, I think specifically, was the machine that wasn't exactly clean room engineered, right? So, but we did have these for a while, and I really like them. They're built like a stinking tank. So this auction, there is one of them, and it looks like it's in nice shape. They say that it powers up, but I don't think they connected it to a monitor to actually see if anything comes out. when it powers up. But they do show the inside of it, and it doesn't look all dust bunnied. You know, it looks clean. Since it powers up, the power supply is at least trying to work, right?
Yeah.
And again, the price was not that bad. $91, buy it now. And only $28 shipping to me from California. I don't know what shipping shows to Massachusetts, or shipping's probably a nightmare to Sweden if they even do it. But
yeah, this one even says, may not ship to Sweden.
Yeah.
I get a lot of those.
What about you, Paul? Does it show what it would cost to...
To me, it's 28 also, so I think that's probably a fixed rate that the seller put in.
See, that's just not bad at all. So, assuming they package it so that it doesn't get all banged up.
Speaking of which, what are the shipping costs you guys see for the Packard HP 85A? Because for me, the shipping cost is $127.
It's $88 for me for what's called expedited shipping.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not terrible if you've ever picked one of these things up.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it looks pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty heavy.
For me, it's $29, but that's because it's just down the road.
Ah.
Okay.
Nice.
So, by the way, Earl, this HP 85A, like, when did this device come out approximately, and what was the main target audience for this? Like, what was it used for primarily? Do you know?
Boy, it's difficult to say what the target audience was. It ran a dialective BASIC, and the engineers tend to like to look at it because they were familiar with the HP test equipment and such, and it did have the connections to use the HP style peripherals with the, what do they call it, the HP IB interface. I'm having to rack my brain to go back to that world. When I worked at that computer store was 1980 and 81, so it must have been around that time that computer was on the market.
Okay, cool. Well, thanks, Earl. Those are both good things to show us here. And, yeah, cool. All right. Moving along. I've got something here. I pulled out at the last minute an Atari Lynx 2 handheld game console for sale for just 10 British pounds, which is very, very cheap. The seller says works, but has a stuck button. So, it seems like there is a bit of a problem with it, but they claim that it works. And if it works, if the button is salvageable, then that's a very, very good price. So this is a handheld gaming device that came out in the mid-90s. Now, the Lynx came out earlier. I think Epix was the one who developed this thing. And then when they were going out of business, I think, is when Atari swooped it up from them. And so the first Lynx came out in the early 90s, or maybe even 89, I'm not sure. And the Lynx 2 came out a few years later. It was just kind of a slimmed down version of the same thing. But a very cool gaming platform, nice color display. If there had been any justice in the world, this thing would have wiped the floor with the Nintendo Game Boy, but that's not what happened. Because Atari.
I've always been kind of curious about that because, yeah, wow. This thing had it going on.
Yep. Yeah, this thing was really... It was really amazing. A friend of mine had one of these in college, and it was really, really nice. One of the unique things about the Lynx, as far as I know, is it was designed to be totally left or right-hand switchable. So it has a D-pad on one end and actually two pairs of control buttons on the other end so that you can set it up to flip it around the other way. So you want the D-pad on the right instead of the left. You have the control buttons in the exact same spot they would have been on your left hand, on your left thumb. So... good trivia there. Anyway, just £10 seems like a good deal.
Yeah.
I might even go for this one myself. I almost never do that when I'm students in school. This has another 4, almost 5 days to go. So.
Okay, so I should go slow on the editing.
Yes. Hold off. Hold off the editing until this one's done. So that's it for me. Paul, you've got a set of items here.
Yeah, I have a I have three. Maybe I'll talk about them. I think I will. So the first one is a TRS-80 disc video interface for the Model 100. There's an auction. I've seen a couple of these go by. It's not super cheap. It is listed for $220, but there is a make offer option. One of the things that I think is kind of neat about this is that it's the packaging is there. So there's the original disc, there's the cable, there's the box, although it looks like the top's been torn off, and the styrofoam that goes around the interface. Now, what this thing is, basically, so those Model 100s that, you know, ride around on Roombas, they have a little screen, a little LCD screen, and what this disc video interface allows you to do is connect an actual floppy disk drive to it and show the output on a screen. So they're big. They look like basically a desktop computer sized thing. And it seems like they're relatively rare. They seem pretty cool. I have one. In fact, I can see it right now. but I haven't been able to try it because I don't have the cable. And apparently the cable is kind of an annoying thing to have to create. So one thing that's nice about this is it has the cable. Have either of you seen one of these before?
No, I did not know this existed. So this thing, it reads floppies, and it has video out for connecting to a monitor or a TV.
Mm-hmm.
Even an RF modulator looks like it can actually switch between channel 4 or 3. So basically lets you both read discs and take the entire display of what would be in your Model 100 and have that display go on to next full screen as well. Is that the idea?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it might just be a... that's the thing. I haven't tried this yet, but I think it may just be kind of like a terminal, you know? So like it's text scrolling up. I don't know if you can address whatever it would be, like 20 some lines, but...
Hmm. Right, so it might just be a screen that is the same size as the Model 100 screen.
Oh, it must be taller. That would be really horrible. Yeah, still have 5 lines in the middle of your TV.
This little wedge.
I have never seen one in person. I've seen them before on eBay, and I've seen the folks in the Model 100 mail list and, you know, the forums and that talking about it.
Complaining about the stupid cable.
No, I never saw that before. That's new information to me.
Yeah, I think there's one cable for the Model 100 and a different cable for the 102. And I believe the one for the Model 100 has a property that basically the pins are organized in such a way that it's just kind of a monster to make. Everything has to cross all over every way. Like, I don't know. It's apparently just a not a fun cable to try to build. So anyway, yeah. I mean, so this $220 is, that's pretty high for this, although it does, you know, it's in great shape. The box is not in great shape, but it's there. You might try offering for this. I think this particular seller does have a tendency to sell things that are often on the high end of the prices, but you know, there's an offer.
Cool.
Okay, I'll quickly zip by one other one. So there's a Coco, a Radio Shack Coco 1 set that actually looks kind of interesting. It's listed in kind of a weird way, which is, and the main picture has everything covered by these dust covers, so you can't actually see what it is. So it's possible that you might see this and somebody else who would have been interested in it won't. So it's a Coco 1. It's an appliance controller, one of these X10 light controllers. It has a Radio Shack cassette tape, and it has actually also the cartridge for the light controller and 2 joysticks. So not bad. It's up for bid. It has 8 days left, and there it has no bids, but the first bid is $1 and $15 shipping. So this is this has to sell.
It does say does not power up, includes everything pictured.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I don't know to what extent a non-powering up Coco 1 is fixable.
No, who knows? But I would guess that light controller works no matter what.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're interested for that, I'm sure that's there. And probably those joysticks probably work and other stuff probably works. So for someone who's into the Coco, this is probably a pretty good deal. I like the way that it's listed as the Radio Shack TRS-80 Zaxxon.
Yeah.
Number, low serial number. And the reason they say Zaxxon is because this includes a cassette tape on which the word Zaxxon is written.
In pen.
In pen, red pen. It's not like, it's as if this was a product or contained a product called Zaxxon, but I assume that is a Zaxxon game on there of some kind, but it's not, yeah. It's just somebody's copy on a tape.
It also says it has a low serial number. The serial number says 3767, but my impression of the serial numbers on these is that it's actually a little bit hard to track them. So this is specifically 263003A. You know, this is a particular run of the Coco, and so this is probably 3767 of that run, but I don't think that makes this necessarily super old.
Right. Anyway, for a dollar, not bad.
Yeah, definitely. That's what I say. It must sell. I mean, if nothing else, maybe I will submit a dollar later. But the last one is the most impressive. It's probably also the least applicable to people. But it's basically just a bunch of pets, a bunch of Commodore pets. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them. Actually, I see a couple Apple IIs in this picture as well. But so there's PET 2001, there's a CBM 8032, another PET 2001. It's being listed for $1,000 buy it now, and you ship it yourself from Sherman, Texas, or go get it. But there are enough PETs there that does not actually seem way off the market value. You can make an offer. I don't know. Anyway, it looks pretty impressive, and they look in relatively good shape, even though they don't look like they're being stored all that carefully. There are a couple of dual floppy disk drives, which themselves are pretty rare, and a printer. So it's neat to look at. And if you happen to be in Sherman, Texas, you maybe should just go get this.
The 2001's in here with the chiclet keyboard. Finding a chiclet keyboard completely intact like this, like the one that I'm looking at, that's pretty rare. Without all the markings rubbed off and everything. This chiclet keyboard actually, well, there's a little bit of the markings rubbed off in the lower right, but it looks better than a lot of them that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And actually, yeah, there are two of them. And the second one seems like it has a better shaped keyboard, even though the tape drive is gone.
Right. So you can probably mix and match and put together the good keyboard and the tape player into one. I noticed the seller is also doing a nice, honest bit of showing the powered on screens for all of these, three of which look fine and two of which look like interesting looking garbage, but maybe that's something that's fixable. Yeah, the PET is something I have never used a Commodore PET. I've never even seen one in person, I don't think. This was just never on my radar at the time, and yeah, I don't know.
They look so cool.
I have no experiences at all. They are cool looking. They look very like sci-fi.
Yeah. No, I have, what do I have, 8032? I have sitting next to one right now, but it was definitely one of those things that was on my list, you know, like, just because of its shape, I wanted to get it. Yeah. Haven't done much with it, though. I think I mentioned this at some previous episode of this, but I got a flashcard solution for it that I actually have to solder together myself, but once I do that, it should, I should be able to, play Zork. Whatever one does on a PET.
Finally, you can play Zork.
which model of PET do you say you have?
I have a 8032, I think. Let me just move the thing that's in front of this thing.
Oh, you should be able to do quite a bit with that.
Yeah, hopefully it's it has lots of columns and a fair amount of memory.
All right, good. Thanks, Paul. Well, we're reaching the end of our session here. Closing discussions. Does anybody have anything to add here? Earl, you've got something interesting you mentioned about fourth here.
A couple things. Yeah. I'm trying to port fourth the computer language and environment over to the Commodore 128. There are several implementations for the 64, but I've never seen anything for the 128 that takes advantage of its several advantages. Like it's got 80 columns and it can run at 2 megahertz, not just 1, and it has more RAM, hence the whole 128 thing. So in this process, I've been learning about the complex, kind of convoluted, but really interesting way that the memory banks are organized in the 128 and how you can take advantage of them. So at some point I'll write that up in a blog entry. It is out there. You can get the information out there, but you got to kind of dig for it.
Right.
Yeah, it's anyway, this whole fourth thing is a lot of work. but I'm going to keep at it because I really do want to actually accomplish it this time. My second thing that I wanted to bring up, I had this weird flash thought, and it may be absolutely stupid, but there might be something to it. There are one or two places out there on the internet that you can go get new in box 5 1/4 inch floppy disks. But if you press them on where the floppy disk came from, they're stock from the 90s. And, you know, even though this one company in particular, the name of which escapes me at the moment, they're popular in the vintage computer world, and people say the floppies they got for them or from them have been very good and nobody's had any problems. I still wonder about the shelf life of floppy disks. And it pains me that there's nowhere to go get new floppy disks. They're just not available. And the idea came to me, what about a Kickstarter? Would there be enough people that would want to have actual floppy disks that somebody that used to make floppy disks could maybe fire up the old assembly line and, you know, make some new floppy disks? When I started to think about how many people are in retro computing, I thought those numbers just might not add up. I mean, it might cost too much to try to reconstitute the manufacturing capability for these. Conversely, I thought in the 20-year time span since the last time these things were pressed, we've made advances in magnetic media and in chemistry and material fabrication and a variety of things. I wondered, if we were to make floppy disks in 2015, would they not be better floppy disks? Might they have a shelf life of 30 or 40 years or something like that? And, you know, the other thing I was thinking is, since the floppy disks have been failing, people have been migrating to SD card solutions or compact flash solutions, and they're used to it now, so maybe this ship has sailed. So I thought I'd ask what you guys thought about that, and, you know, if listeners want to send us email to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, I'd be interested what they thought too. If there was enough interest in this, you know, it might be worth approaching a couple places and saying, hey, how much would it cost to cook up some new ones? I remember back in the day, the Dysons and some of the premium floppy disks cost $50 a box, and that wouldn't seem unreasonable to me if I could get freshly minted, high quality 2015 floppy disks.
Yeah, I think there's definitely potential for a market there. And I think you're absolutely right about the technology, because of course magnetic media is still being used for tape all the time. You know, it's less and less prevalent, but there are definitely lots of tape backups still happening in the world. There are still audio cassettes being made of various kinds. Reel-to-reel tape is still being made, as far as I know. And I think that my understanding is that making floppy disk material and making magnetic tape material is essentially the same kind of thing at its core. So yeah, if they make new disks now, they probably would be much better than the disks that were made back in the day. It would probably retain data longer and better and stuff. And I think that, and I can imagine that there could be a market for people who want to have new floppies just to be able to continue using their old computers in the way they used to use them. I mean, people like to have the SD card solution. I love to have that. But at the same time, there is this nice quality to the sound and movement of a classic floppy drive, the grinding noises and the weird stuff that, like, my children have never been exposed to. They've never heard or seen this. I can tell them about it. They're like, yeah, whatever. I would like them to see more of the experience of the frustration, the time waiting, the loading, right. Will it work? Will it not work? All that good stuff.
That was excellent. I can tell you've heard that more than once.
Oh, yeah. It's like, there's a lot of warm feelings about listening to music on vinyl records instead of on CD, because you get the nice little sort of popping and crackling and ruined discs and all these nice things that everyone seems to want to have. I definitely think that there is a point to that, because right now I think that most of the time, if you try and deal with floppies from back in the day, now you'll hit too much frustration that it won't even feel good for the most part. I mean, sure, back then you'd be using floppies, now and then one would be ruined. You know, you'd save something and something wouldn't work. But I think that percentage is probably much, much higher now with old media. So yeah, I think there's a market for it.
I think it would be interesting to talk to somebody, if you can find someone from like 3M or someone who is actually on the process end of this to just get some real idea of what they did, how it compares to what they do now. Because one of the things that occurs to me is that there's a difference between these like the high density disks and the double density disks and even single density, I suppose, and in terms of the actual magnetic, the media on the disk, such that if you have a high density disk and you try to use it in an older, double density drive, it's quite unreliable. You can write and you may be able to read it a couple times, but then it stops working. So that's why you're always trying to get the double density disks for your old computers, not the more plentiful high density ones. And I just kind of wonder, that seems like an issue that's going to play into this. We can make media better now, but I wonder if we need to make media kind of worse in order to work with the drives.
Well, I'm not so sure that it's worse as in just different. I mean, I remember hearing the term magnetic coercivity, and I'm impressed that I can even say that.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Yes. So I think that that has something to do with it, and I don't understand all the magnetics around it, but they are not just different in quality, they're different in essence. And so that would definitely have to be taken into account.
The company that people usually refer to is Athena. I don't know how those vowels are pronounced, but they're the ones that stockpiled a huge number of disks in the distant past and then sell them to you new in box.
Gotcha. And I think there might have been one other place as well. I have to go out and search for it, but definitely that's one of the ones that is heavily talked about.
All right, cool. Paul, what do you have as we wrap up here for the day?
I have not too much to report. I feel like I'm still doing much of the same thing. But one thing that I did manage to do just yesterday, which I thought was kind of cool, I don't know if I can translate this into an interesting closing shot or not. But so among the things that I've been doing with the Apple II is capturing disk images with a specialized card, the EDD card that will read the bits a little bit more directly off the disk. And I have also a compact flash solution for the Apple II called the Unis disk that was made by Nishida Radio. And I think actually they're not being made anymore, which is a little too bad. But at any rate, I discovered that in the operation of the Unis disk, what it does is basically you put a disk image on there, you plug it into your Apple II, and it does a little internal conversion into a format, a special sort of internal format for itself called a NIC file. And I looked a little bit at the NIC file, and it turned out that actually it's basically the same format that the EDD file is in. So I was actually able to take an EDD file, put it on the compact flash card. So this was like a disk that was protected and not normally copyable, and was actually able to at least load up the beginning of the boot process off the compact flash card with a still protected floppy on real hardware, which is pretty cool. It's only the beginning of this project. So I still have to work on how to translate these EDD files a little bit more concisely and accurately. But there is some hope that a protected disk could be sampled on a real machine into an EDD file and then booted again on a different real machine through a compact flash card. That's where I'm hoping. What I'm actually hoping is that I will be able to do this in time to take this to Kansas Fest and be able to do deprotect disks that I don't even have with me.
Right.
We'll see.
Cool. All right. Good luck with that.
Thanks.
Man, that is awesome. That is serious preservation, being able to preserve even those copy protection errors. That's mm-hmm. so cool.
Well, you know, actually, just because I was supposed to be done here, but you know, that's one activity that a lot of people had in their past, you know, and would sort of like to preserve is, you know, the actual puzzle of cracking copy protection. You know, that there is a value in the creation of and the understanding and the deprotecting this copy protection, and so just managing to get, you know, some copy of the underlying software isn't quite the same as actually being able still in 10 years to crack something. So so I definitely do want to be able to preserve the protection as well as the software underneath it.
Cool.
Anyway, now I'm done.
All right. Excellent. Well, that concludes it for this show. You can find show notes for all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. Follow RCR on Twitter, at RCR Podcast, where we do post things from time to time. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a proud member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. You will find us and many, many other podcasts of people talking about old stuff that most of the people have forgotten about, but we want to remember. So please write a review on iTunes, because that's what keeps the big bucks rolling in. And until next time,
Retro Compute. Da 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 da